Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for waking up this Saturday morning. We're going through a slight heat wave here in Philadelphia, so I hope everybody's trying to stay cool with some air conditioning, some fans, keeping the windows open, drinking iced tea, whatever you need to do. But we're also talking about a really hot, hot topic today. The New Jim Crow with author Michelle Alexander. Let me read you some of the quotes people are talking about her book. Michelle Alexander's brave and bold new book paints a haunting picture in which dreary felon garb, post-prison joblessness, and the loss of voting rights now do the stigmatizing work once done by colored-only water fountains and legally segregated schools. With dazzling candor, Alexander argues that we all pay the cost of the new Jim Crow. That's Lonnie Guinier, professor at Harvard Law School and the author of The Miner's Canary. There's so many other things I could say, but I want to read a quote from her book here before I start talking with her. A heavy and cruel hand has been laid upon us. As a people, we feel ourselves to be not only deeply injured, but grossly misunderstood. Our white countrymen do not know us. They are strangers to our character, ignorant of our capacity, oblivious to our history and progress, and are misinformed as to the principles and ideas that control and guide us as a people. The great mass of American citizens estimates us as being a characterless and purposeless people, and hence we hold up our heads, if at all, against the withering influence of a nation's scorn and contempt. Now, when do you think that was written? That was actually by Frederick Douglass in a statement on behalf of delegates to the National Colored Convention held in Rochester, New York in July 1853. Yet I feel that that statement is so important to today's conversation, that people are not aware of who and what we are and the moral choices that we make, nor are we ourselves aware. We ourselves are digesting the myths about us as the African American people and what we're capable of or not capable of. I want to welcome Michelle Alexander. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for calling in this morning. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. I think your book is wonderful. As I mentioned earlier, insightful, educational. Probably should be taught in elementary schools. I don't know. Where do we begin? But let's start just first with, why did you think it was important to write this book?
Well, you know, I was inspired to write this book after years of working as a civil rights lawyer on issues of racial profiling, police brutality, drug law enforcement in poor communities of color. I was working on behalf of, you know, people returning home from prison, struggling just to survive, struggling to, quote, unquote, re-enter into a society that didn't seem to have much use for them in the first place. And I had a series of experiences that began what I call my awakening to the reality, our racial reality in America. And I became increasingly alarmed by the failure of so many of the major civil rights organizations to make the mass incarceration of people of color in the United States a top priority. And I became appalled by the silence of so many African-American leaders on the issue of mass incarceration in the United States.
Well, one of the things you try to do is, like you mentioned, the historical perspective, starting from slavery to Jim Crow. Your book is called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration and Age of Colorblindness. For those of you who are not aware about Jim Crow laws, you definitely need to go read her book and read other books that are out there. But one of the things I want to read, we were talking, Michelle and I, earlier about the Marion Wright Edelman. She's the head of the Children's Defense Fund, had written an article April 2010 of this year. And I just want to read a little bit of it to you. Now, imagine you're a parent, and in the middle of your neighborhood, there is a playground. Of course, you want that playground to be a joyful, creative space. If your neighborhood were a crowded public housing development in the middle of a city, the chance to bring your children to a small outdoor sanctuary where they could stretch their bodies and imaginations would be even more precious. You might hope the jungle gym would include a pretend steering wheel, storefront, or spaceship, like the equipment in thousands of playgrounds across the country. Imagine then if instead the quote-unquote sanctuary the city provided for your children featured a pretend jail. Yes, you heard me right. I didn't read that mistakenly. It says it featured a pretend jail. Michelle, you're aware of this, yes?
Yes. You know, I think people have been slow to recognize in the United States is that there is a current caste system, a current racial caste system operating in the United States today. It operates through our criminal justice systems, but it manages to oppress and control African Americans, poor African Americans, nearly as effectively as earlier systems of racial control once did. And our youth are being socialized, are being trained to accept their admission into this new system is inevitable. And so, you know, putting pretend jails, in a playground in front of a housing project is just kind of the first step in socializing, you know, our young people into the thinking that going to prison and jail is a natural, normal, inevitable part of life. The thesis of my book is that, you know, just a few decades after the collapse of the old Jim Crow, you know, we as a nation have managed to recreate racial caste in America. Now, many people dismiss this as, you know, exaggeration or hyperbole. They say, well, just look at Barack Obama. Just look at Oprah Winfrey. Haven't we finally triumphed over race? But in some major American cities, the majority of African American men are locked behind bars or labeled felons for life. And once you're labeled a felon, you're trapped. You're trapped in a permanent second-class status in which you may be denied the right to vote, automatically excluded from juries, legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon, and the branding of millions of poor people of color, particularly African American men, as felons during the past few decades has not been the product of crime rates. It has not been, you know, some freak accident. It's instead the direct result of a backlash against the civil rights movement and a get tough movement that was first inspired by former segregationists who found that they could no longer say, you know, segregation forever, and instead had to say law and order, get tough, and use that rhetoric to mobilize the racial resentment of poor and working class whites, particularly in the South. And the mobilization of that resentment by, you know, Richard Nixon and, Ronald Reagan and many other conservative politicians birthed the war on drugs, a war that has not been aimed at ending drug use, abuse, or sales, but instead has been a war on poor communities of color.
Michelle, I just want to interrupt you. Now, you know that people are listening to this and say, oh, my God, here they go again, these black people. I work with black people. I go to school with black people. I'm in college. I'm getting my PhD with black people. We have a black president, like you said, there's the open one. Okay, those are exceptions. But in general, I have a lot of good black people in my life. I have a lot of good black friends in my life. I mean, are you serious? I mean, if somebody's caught with drugs in their car, if they're caught with drugs walking down the street, if they're caught with drugs on a bus, are you telling me that we shouldn't imprison them? They kind of gave up their rights, Michelle. I mean, you know people are saying this. What is your retort to that?
My response is that the war on drugs was not declared in response to drug crime. The drug war was actually declared, the current drug war was officially declared in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan at a time when drug crime was on the decline, not on the rise. It was declared, you know, years before crack first hit the streets in Los Angeles and later spread to communities of color across America. The drug war was part of that racial backlash that I described. In fact, if you doubt this, consider the words of H.R. Haldeman, you know, former President Richard Nixon's chief of staff. He said, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they succeeded. You know, although studies have shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. They have been targeted at grossly disproportionate rates. In fact, you know, in some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been African American. And if you believe that this drug war has been aimed at, you know, violent offenders or drug kingpins, a lot of times people say, well, yeah, we're waging the drug war in those ghetto communities because that's where all the violent offenders are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know. All the violent people are.
Right.
Let me read a little bit from your book. This is from a section called States of Denial, which I think is apropos to what we're talking about. I was trying to get people to realize this really is happening. This is not make-believe. You know, racism still exists, but in a different form. Laws are being changed so that you can't even use the word race, and that's one of the reasons you need to pick up Michelle's book. She goes in detail about the changes in the different civil rights laws, the different criminal laws that make it very easy for people to be stopped and frisked on a bus or standing on a corner. And yes, okay, maybe you're a black male with a group of other black males. That's not the only reason we stopped you. We stopped you because you're wearing baggy pants, the way your hair is cut, the way you're standing. Oh, yeah, okay, so you're black. That's the small, minor detail. And you know what? That race card is thrown out the window because of all the other things, maybe where you were standing, what neighborhood you were standing in, and so on and so forth. So let me just read this section of States of Denial. This is in Michelle's book, The New Jim Crow. Please pick it up. It's by The New Press. Much has been written about the ways in which people manage to deny, even to themselves, that extraordinary atrocities, racial oppression, and other forms of human suffering have occurred or are occurring. Criminologist Stanley Cohen wrote perhaps the most important book on the subject, States of Denial. The book examines how individuals and institutions, victims and perpetrators and bystanders, know about yet deny the occurrence of oppressive acts. They see only what they want to see and wear blinders to avoid seeing the rest. This has been true about slavery, genocide, torture, and every form of systemic oppression. You need to pick up The New Jim Crow. It'll definitely educate you about what's going on. I also want to read a small section, Michelle, just real quick. When people say, well, why do you think, you know, they're only picking black people? That's not true. Well, the black people are more violent. Black people commit more crimes. The black people don't know how to control themselves. Black people don't have morals. I mean, so on and so forth. Even our own people, you mentioned in the book about Bill Cosby, talk about, you know, people not being responsible. Let me just read this part here. At other stages of the criminal justice process, the court has indicated that over-racial bias necessarily triggers strict scrutiny, a concession that has not been costly, as very few law enforcement officials today are foolish enough to admit bias openly. But the Supreme Court has indicated that in policing, race can be used as a factor in discretionary decision-making. I'll repeat that. Race can be used as a factor in discretionary decision-making, and this is based on a case, United States versus Brignone-Ponce, and this was in car stopping related to a Mexican-American person. But this can be used with any minorities, but today we're talking about African-American males. Michelle, what do we need to do? What can we do as a people? I mean, if somebody committed a crime, they're carrying coke, they're carrying marijuana, what can we do as a normal everyday citizen to combat this?
Well, listen, you know, I think it's really important for people to recognize, again, that, you know, people of all races use and sell drugs. In fact, you know, the studies indicate that white youth are actually more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth, but we don't see police raids of college campuses and fraternity houses and universities. We don't see police raids of middle-class suburban communities. You know, they say, well, we're waging the drug war in poor communities of color because that's where the violent offenders are, but the drug war has never, I repeat, never been aimed primarily at rooting out violent offenders or drug kingpins. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 was for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or significant selling activity. You know, in fact, in the 1990s, the period of the greatest expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, you know, a drug less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, and equally, if not more prevalent in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in communities of color. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, resulting in millions of young people being branded as criminals, branded as felons at young ages, often before they reach voting age, and then ushered into a permanent second-class status where, you know, so many of the rights that were supposedly won in the civil rights movement are stripped from them.
Let's talk about the rights. We talk about, okay, people are going to jail. People, quote, unquote, committed a crime. They're going to jail. You talk about the mandatory sentencing, the longer sentencing for crack. Crack and cocaine are the same, you know, issue, item, so to speak, or chemical, but crack is given more. You know, we're talking now about whites use drugs just as much as blacks. As a matter of fact, one of the things you talk about in the book is that whites sell drugs to other whites. We see on TV, which you also mentioned in your book about the media, is that, you know, whites are coming into the black urban communities buying drugs, okay, this and that. But that's not really the case as a whole. Whites are buying drugs from their friends next door, from, you know, from somebody in their neighborhood. Blacks are buying drugs from other blacks. Nobody's crossing over the lines. Our United States is still very segregated. But let's talk about, okay, they get arrested. Now they're in jail. Okay, they come out. What happens to them, Michelle? They're losing their voting rights, yes? What else are they losing?
Yeah, you're automatically excluded from juries for the rest of your life if you've been branded a felon. You know, all white juries have had a roaring comeback in many places in the United States because so many African Americans have been branded felons. But then
also they can't get public housing. You come out of jail, you have $10 in your pocket, and here's a bus ticket. Go back home. Where do you sleep? You sleep on the street because you can't get public housing.
You
can't get welfare.
Right.
Yes,
you cannot. If you've been convicted of a drug felony, you're barred from public housing for a minimum of 5 years, and regulations encourage public housing agencies to discriminate against folks for the rest of their lives. Every job application has that box. You know, you got to check, have you ever been convicted of a felony? It doesn't matter if that felony happened last week or 30 years ago. For the rest of your life, you got to check that box, and you are subject to legalized discrimination against you. About 70% of employers won't even think about hiring someone convicted of a felony. You know, that application goes straight in the trash. So here you are, you can't get a job. You're barred from public housing. Certainly aren't getting any private housing in the private market. You have nowhere to sleep, no job. Food stamps are off limits to you. You are ineligible even for food stamps if you're convicted of a drug felony for the rest of your life. Pregnant
so
women.
So what are you supposed to do? I mean, people wonder why people are walking around, a recidivism rate is so high. In our country,
exactly.
It's a 50, 60% recidivism rate. I want to read something just from Time Magazine online. They just had an article in May 2010. It says, Norway builds the world's most humane prison. This prison cost $252 million to make. And they have places to run. They have small kitchens. They have flat-screen TVs inside the jail cells. In Norway, the recidivism rate for prisoners is 20%. In the UK, the U.S., the figure is 60%.
Yes.
So what are we doing wrong here?
Well, we're making it impossible for people to survive on the outside. You release somebody with, you know, $20. You know, a bus pass, nowhere to sleep, you know, no, can't get a job, you can be legally discriminated against, no food stamps, and then get this. Most prisoners are saddled with hundreds or thousands of dollars in debt. They're expected to pay back fees, fines, court costs. In a growing number of states, you're expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment, accumulated back child support, and then get this. Up to 100% of your wages can be garnished to pay back all these fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. So even if you're one of the lucky
that's one of the things that Michelle, that's one of the things I learned in your book. I was not aware because I'm walking around, I'm a little bougie, light, bright self that I am. People know me, know I'm light skin, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm paying all this, my tax money is going to pay for the prisoners, but now you're telling me, you just broke a myth for me, that they are actually paying in some states, because states are the ones that are controlling, not the federal government, that they have to pay back all these fees. So in one of your stories in the book, there's a guy. He was in jail. He served his time, a nonviolent crime. and he had to pay $900 back in fees before he could vote. But he couldn't pay $900 back because, one, he couldn't get welfare, he couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
What does he do? Where does
exactly.
he get his money from? You know,
what
now,
is he
I definitely, you know,
do? You know, what
I
is the system
here.
Designed
let me,
to do?
Let me, Michelle, let me take this caller. Let me have a question. Good morning, caller. How are you?
I'm fine, Joy. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question for our guest this morning?
Yeah. I'd just like to say hello to the guest on Michelle Alexander.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. The question I have is in regards to the laws about drug felonies or whatever. And I think earlier you said that, you know, basically one way or the other that they'll get you or get these young black males for just possession of drugs. But there's also the aspect of men getting locked up for perceived violence. You know, domestic violence laws are kind of, you know, constructed, you know, the same way where there wasn't an actual violent crime committed. It's just the way that the laws are set up, and they end up basically in the same situation. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Thank you so much for calling in. Where are you calling from?
I'm from Ohio.
Okay, thank you so much. I'll let Michelle respond. Hold on.
I don't spend much time in the book talking about domestic violence cases or even violent crime generally, and the reason is that, you know, our prison population has quintupled, not doubled, tripled, quintupled, gone from about 300,000 to close to 2.5 million in 3 decades, and this increase has not been driven by violent crime. It has not been driven by violent crime. People always say, oh, you know, the explosion in our prison population, you know, is due to all these gangbangers in the hood and violent crime. It's just not true. The explosion in our prison population has been driven by nonviolent and drug-related offenses, the same sorts of crimes that occur with, you know, similar frequency in middle-class white communities and on college campuses but are ignored. Yet young folks of color are expected to forfeit their lives for making the same types of mistakes that get a wink and a nod if made on the other side of town, and that's what I
Michelle,
think.
Michelle, let me bring up one of the issues you talk in your book is that people may not be aware, but local precinct states were being given money by the Reagan administration. The more drug criminals they captured, the more money they got. Not only that, Michelle, you need to pick up the book, The New Jim Crow. She talks about that when they captured these quote unquote criminals, whether they were or not, any property, money, or drugs that person had, the local precinct was able to keep. So there was this boom. People were getting, you know, helicopters and military level equipment. They were giving access to CIA information. This is the money was being funneled. So things were kind of being made up, if you will say, to like, yeah, we're doing great. We're arresting a lot of people today. Let's go out and get everybody. So states and cities were making money off of the number of people they'd be arresting. And now who were they arresting? Unfortunately, they're arresting people of color.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you know,
federal funding
people
flows,
have biases.
That's exactly right. Federal funding flows to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost dramatically the volume, the sheer number of arrests. So, you know, maybe even saw the New York Times article just, you know, a few days ago that was showing that New York police officers were being rewarded in cash for the number of arrests. And so they were fanning out into these poor communities, into ghetto communities, and just, you know, stopping and frisking everybody, trying to shake down as many people as they could in an effort to boost their numbers. Because that's, they made money off of these low-level arrests. Now, those kinds of tactics would never fly in middle-class, suburban, white communities. So it doesn't happen there. It doesn't happen there.
Well, that's one of the things your book talks about. If we say black crime, what comes to people's minds?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we say white crime, let's just, anybody who's listening today, I say the word white crime, what comes to your mind? What images come to mind? What type of person comes to your mind? What type of crime committed under the phrase white crime comes to your mind? So these are things that we need to think about. One of the things she talks about is implicit and explicit biases that people have. Many of you may not be aware of that you have implicit bias. You may have black friends. You may go out and meet black friends. You may meet Chinese friends, whatever the case is. But under certain points of pressure, internal biases come out in many cases. I have some other callers. Let me take another caller. 919 area code. Good morning.
Hi. How you doing, Joy?
Good, good. Do you have a question for the guest this morning?
I do. I'm a person of mixed race. I'm active duty military and currently working on my PhD in public policy. There is no doubt that I'm in complete agreement with what she's saying here, but I have one important question. Are you looking at trying to change the laws as far as how they apply to particular types of crime, or are you more interested in stopping the crimes from happening? Because I think most people would agree that once these crimes are committed, regardless of the race, you know, there should be some form of punishment the way the laws are, whether the person's black, white, Latino. So are we talking at changing the policy toward drug crimes? That it seems to be the focus of what you're talking about. Are you saying that we shouldn't be punishing these people at all, or, you know, we need to start punishing the other people equally to balance out the equation?
Okay, thank you so much. I'll let her respond. Thank you.
That's an excellent question. Now, here, you know, a lot of times I'll have people tell me, well, if these young people just wouldn't use or sell drugs, then, you know, there would be no excuse to round them up. So we can solve this problem by just getting everybody to stop breaking the law. Now, I think that's a failed strategy. Why? Because young people and adults, we all make mistakes. You know, Barack Obama has admitted to using drugs, you know, quite a bit in his youth. You know, what if he had been arrested, you know, branded a felon? What if he hadn't been insulated by being raised by, you know, white grandparents in Hawaii and instead was growing up in the hood and got arrested for his drug use and got branded a felon? It's more likely he'd be cycling in and out of prison today than being president of the United States. He probably wouldn't even have the right to vote depending on what state he lived in. So, you know, I don't think the answer is simply telling young people don't make mistakes. Now, of course, we should be encouraging young people not to break the law, to value themselves and honor their bodies and only put substances in them that are good for them. You know, but we're all criminals. We've all violated the law. You know, if you speed on the freeway, you are likely, you know, to cause more harm than someone who smokes a joint, you know, in the privacy of their own home. So we have all broken the law. We've all made mistakes. The question is, you know, how do we respond to the mistakes that young people and all people inevitably make, especially drug use? Drug use, I believe, is a public health problem. Shouldn't be treated like a crime. Now, I support the decriminalization of marijuana because now, you know, the scientific evidence clearly shows it's less harmful than tobacco or alcohol, and the drug war has been, you know, focused on rounding people up for marijuana offenses for a long
time
now.
Michelle, I'm sorry. We only have 1 minute left. So what I want to tell the caller is, from my reading of the book, just real quickly, she definitely believes that somebody who committed crime should serve the time. The question also comes, though, who's being picked up for crime, and did they really actually commit the crime because of plea bargaining and other things that are happening? And lastly, once they get out, what supports are out there to help them get back into the community once they did serve their time? Okay, they were in jail for 50 years. What can we do to help them? We're barring them from money, from housing, from jobs, so what do we want them to do? Pick up her book, anybody listening, The New Jim Crow. You can see her historical connections between slavery, Jim Crow, and now this mass incarceration. I just want to say thank you so much, Michelle, for coming on this morning. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but thank you so much for coming on, and please pick up her book, The New Jim Crow. Also, I'm giving away one of her books. Email me at Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Tell me what does the W.E.B. and W.E.B. Du Bois stand for. Again, if you want one of her books, email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com, and you can get a free copy of her book, The New Jim Crow. Tell me what W.E.B. stands for in W.E.B. Du Bois' name. Thank you so much, Michelle, for coming on this morning.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Have a wonderful Saturday.
You too.
Okay. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to today's show. Definitely a hot topic. We could spend a couple hours talking about it. Please pick up her book, The New Jim Crow, or you can win a copy of her book. Just email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. What does W.E.B. Du Bois W.E.B. Stanford and W.E.B. Du Bois' name. I'm going to be doing a second half of today's show, 11:30, with Chef Silva Sanat from Budokan. And if you listen to that show, you could win a dinner for two to Budokan here in Philadelphia. I'm also going to be talking about a program called CCAP. It's a nonprofit that helps high school students nationwide get into the culinary arts. So please stay tuned for the 11:30 segment. Also, you can follow me on Twitter.com. Thank you so much for listening.